ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 25th of March. I'm Nick Grimm, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Russian President Vladimir Putin is dragging Ukraine into the deadly attack on a Moscow concert being claimed by an offshoot of Islamic State. At least 137 people were killed when gunmen opened fire at a rock concert in suburban Moscow before setting the building ablaze. President Putin claims terrorists suspected of the attack were attempting to flee to Ukraine when they were caught. Jacqueline Breen reports.
A day of mourning in Russia. With flags at half-mast, there's shock and grief at vigils being held across the country.
It is unimaginable, impossible to even think about it, to shoot people like that, innocent civilians.
2 days after the attack, rescuers were still searching the Crocus City Hall on Sunday, the death toll rising as more bodies were found. Many are yet to be identified. This man is still looking for his wife, going from hospital to hospital across Moscow.
The last time Yana contacted me was from the concert hall. Her seats were located in the front rows. She sent me one photo and sent me a second photo, the view from the place where they were sitting. I wrote to her, then sent a second message. The first message was read on WhatsApp. The second message wasn't.
Four suspected attackers were arrested on Saturday, among 11 detained on suspicion of involvement, according to President Vladimir Putin. In a nighttime address to the nation, President Putin told Russians they were captured while fleeing to Ukraine, and the suggestion was dismissed by US Vice President Kamala Harris.
No, there is no whatsoever any evidence, and in fact what we know to be the case is that ISIS-K is actually, by all accounts, responsible for what happened.
ISIS-K is the Islamic State group's affiliate in Afghanistan, which has claimed responsibility for the attack but hasn't explained why. The White House says it passed warnings of a planned attack in Moscow to the Russians in recent weeks. Former CIA officer John Cipher used to run the agency's Russia operations in Moscow.
The way to look at it is a country like Russia is very, the security services are very large and very powerful, but they're much more focused on what you'd call regime security versus national security. What I mean by that is they are about keeping Vladimir Putin or the leadership in power at all costs. So they spend much more time focused on any potential political opposition, anything that could threaten the leadership of Vladimir Putin. So they're much more essentially the shock troops of the Kremlin than they are, you know, taking care of the public.
The attack is the deadliest on Russian soil since the 2004 Beslan school siege, in which 330 people were killed.
Jacqueline Breen reporting. Allegations of discrimination against teachers, students, aged care residents and others are the subject of a damning new report on religious schools and organisations. The investigation by Equality Australia found LGBTQ plus students studying at independent schools are more likely to be discriminated against than supported. It also found 10% of faith-based aged care and social service organisations engage in similar discrimination. It comes as the federal government is weighing religious discrimination reforms, as Annie Guest reports.
As a teacher on Queensland's Gold Coast, this 33-year-old loved his job.
So I was teaching at a large religious school and was religious myself. And I got the opportunity to go and march in a Christian float as part of Mardi Gras. And I thought it was great, you know, being surrounded by like-minded people who'd all had a similar experience being in the church.
But 3 weeks later, the man, who AM has chosen not to identify, faced a confronting work meeting.
Yeah, so I got called to the principal's office and I walked in and they said, you've been identified as a known homosexual, what do you have to say for yourself? And I sat down and went, right, I'm not going to be apologetic for who I am. They said, look, has there been any complaints about my teaching? And they went, oh, no, we love what you do. We love, the kids love you. You're one of the favourite teachers. We just had to bring it to your attention, and that if it's mentioned to us again, we will have to reconsider your employment.
His is one of 26 personal stories detailed in a report by Equality Australia. Co-author Ghassan Kasasia outlines other experiences.
Teachers who've been fired because they're gay, teachers who've been denied promotions, students who've been denied leadership opportunities, and even people who have been discriminated when they've approached faith-based providers for support or services.
The report also examines publicly available records and financial information from religious schools, finding many with lifestyle requirements for staff.
And it's things like you have to be married in a heterosexual marriage and not have sex outside that marriage in order to work there, which means that most gay or trans and many divorced people in de facto relationships, people who have children outside marriage, would also fall foul of these requirements that are being imposed.
Some schools were acknowledged for affirming gay or trans students, including Jewish and Uniting Church schools. But Ghassan Kasasia says 40% of independent schools had discriminatory attitudes and practices, while up to 30% of Catholic schools were controlled by authorities with discriminatory practices. Beyond schooling, faith-based providers of other services were also found wanting.
Things like disability support, aged care, healthcare, those sorts of critical services, we found that 1 in 10 publicly discriminate against LGBTQ plus people, including on statements they put on their website.
The federal government is currently considering new religious discrimination laws, but the detail is unclear. The Law Reform Commission has recommended faith-based schools should no longer be allowed to discriminate based on sexuality or gender identity. But Catholic, Christian and Islamic schools warn that would limit their ability to operate and teach according to their ethos.
Annie Guest reporting. Bullying, isolation and a lack of supports at school. A parliamentary inquiry getting underway in New South Wales this week will look at the experiences of students with disability in the education system. And with the goal of ensuring everyone gets an equal education, advocates will be telling the inquiry they want more pathways for teachers with lived experience to enter the profession. More from National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
Sydney woman Sophie Jeeves loved school, but admits it was challenging. The 26-year-old went to a mainstream school. She was born with multiple disabilities, including cerebral palsy, which impacts her speech, the movement in her hands, and her mobility.
My educational experience was very difficult. I would go afternoons without having a teacher day to assist me. These activities that they would assist me with would look like from reading, writing, to being able to move around the classroom.
Ms. Jeeves said she felt disadvantaged when in her last year of school she was taken out of the classroom to do tests to justify why she needed special provisions for her final exams.
I spent months undergoing rigorous assessments to prove that I required a certain level of assistance and extra time when it came to having a reader and a scribe.
She's among several people who have teamed up with the Cerebral Palsy Alliance to make a submission to a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry, which is looking at the education system for students with disability. The group wants consistent guidelines for support around assessments and pathways for people with disability to enter the teaching workforce. Those are just two of the ideas that will be heard by the inquiry committee. The inquiry chair is Greens MP Abigail Boyd.
At the very worst, we're hearing about children who just cannot get a school place. They go to schools that are not set up for them, that are excluding them, suspending or expelling them. And then at the best case, we hear of schools that have set up sensory rooms or particular plans to manage behaviour and to get the best out of the child.
The inquiry will hear from advocates, academics and current and former students with disability. Ms. Boyd hopes hearing their stories will help create an education system that can be safe and inclusive for all students.
We have under-resourced schooling system and overworked teachers, and unfortunately kids with disability have borne the brunt of that. But in the midst of all of that is good evidence for how we do things better.
Debate over the closure of special schools ignited late last year after the Disability Royal Commissioners were split in their final report over the matter. Sophie Jeeves says it's not a straightforward argument, given the mainstream school system isn't working for students with disability.
Mainstream schools have a long way to become more inclusive and more accessible.
Sydney woman Sophie Jeeves ending that report by Naz Campanella. If you've heard of David McBride, you might know him as the war crimes whistleblower. He's a former military lawyer credited with exposing the misconduct of Australia's special forces in Afghanistan. But as a Four Corners investigation reveals, the truth is not that straightforward. As David McBride awaits sentencing, the journalist he dealt with is speaking for the first time. Grace Tobin reports.
Today, I serve my country.
David McBride is a former military lawyer who blew the whistle. He's pleaded guilty to leaking classified defence documents to the ABC and could face years in jail when he's sentenced later this year.
I never expected to become a whistleblower. I was a true believer. But there comes a point when you see things which are just so wrong, you have to stand up.
McBride is celebrated for exposing the misconduct of Australia's special forces in Afghanistan. He's publicly portrayed as the war crimes whistleblower by his lawyers, supporters, human rights groups and the media. But the ABC journalist he dealt with, Dan Oakes, has told Four Corners it's a misleading narrative.
I think I've finally decided after all this time that it's important that, people know the truth about what happened. It's a much greyer and murkier and messier story than people appreciate.
Oakes says the story McBride wanted him to tell was completely different to the one he published.
He really simply wanted the story to say that the special forces in Afghanistan were being unfairly targeted and unfairly scrutinised and investigated when they shouldn't have been investigated.
For more than a year, Oakes investigated Australia's conduct during the Afghan War and a culture of secrecy and cover-ups. When his seven-part series, The Afghan Files, was published in 2017, it gave an unprecedented insight into allegations of war crimes and resulted in the federal police raiding the ABC. Both men were investigated, but ultimately only McBride was charged.
That's one of the problems with the whistleblower scheme. You just set yourself up to be prosecuted eventually.
It's an outcome Oakes has struggled with.
And I was confronted with the prospect that I was going to walk away scot-free and David was going to be prosecuted. And for me, it was really, really difficult to deal with. It had a substantial effect on me.
McBride has become one of the public faces of a fight for stronger whistleblower protections. Oakes says it's an important cause, but also thinks the truth needs to be told about McBride's motivations for leaking the documents.
You could say in the most technical sense that he did help expose war crimes, but that wasn't his intention.
McBride says some people may have misconstrued what he stood up for.
Whether I'm a war crimes whistleblower or a Defence Force whistleblower or a whistleblower against cover-ups, it doesn't really matter in the sense that I'm someone that stood up for what I believed in and am prepared to go to jail for it.
He says his actions have always been about exposing the ADF leadership.
The war crimes were a symptom of that. I think they were a symptom of the bad leadership. And the people in my sights have always been the generals. Certain parts of the media may have misunderstood what I stood up for. But if people don't understand me, that won't kill me.
David McBride there ending Grace Tobin's report, and you can see her Four Corners investigation at 8:30 tonight on ABC TV or on iView. Indonesia's military says it's investigating after video emerged of what appears to be soldiers brutally torturing a man in Papua. There's been more violence in the restive region in recent days with armed pro-independence rebels killing at least three soldiers. Here's Indonesia correspondent Bill Birtles.
It's hard to watch. In one clip, a man who appears to be Papuan is in a steel drum full of water as at least five men brutally punch and kick his head. They taunt him with racist slurs as one man urges the others to be patient because they'll all get a turn. In another video, the same man is shivering as one of his torturers uses a machete to make cuts on his back. The water he's sitting in has turned a deep red. The video only circulated online in recent days, but human rights group Amnesty believes it was filmed in early February in a central part of Papua, and that the man in the steel drum was one of three men tortured by Indonesian soldiers at the time, with one of the victims later dying. Usman Hamid is Amnesty spokesman in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta.
I have seen this kind of torture many times in Papua, receiving a lot of videos, you know, torture with snakes, torture, you know, by using snakes or using electricity and so on. This has been going on in Papua for many, many years.
Papua is Indonesia's most eastern region and has a decades-long conflict with armed rebels seeking independence from what they see as Indonesian colonial rule. Indonesia has long deployed its military to the region, and the violence cuts both ways. In recent days, three Indonesian soldiers were killed in two separate attacks. A rebel faction also released a video of one of its fighters shooting a group of soldiers. But the brutality of the torture video prompted rare public reactions from Jakarta. A spokesman for the president's office said,
Indonesia is a rule of law country that upholds human rights. We hope our soldiers weren't involved in this barbaric act, but if it's proven true, the individuals must be dealt with firmly.
The head of Indonesia's Military Information Centre, Major General Nugraha Gumilar, confirmed that at least one of the men in the video is a soldier and that the military is investigating. He also said the Papuan man who was tortured is a pro-independence armed fighter. Amnesty's Usman Hamid.
Even if he is a member of, you know, armed rebel, you can't torture them. Even in war time, for example, you can't torture anyone.
This is Bill Birtles in Jakarta reporting for AM.
As the federal government works to double the number of students studying at our universities by the middle of the century, 10 new study hubs will be announced today to boost the chances of those who've long struggled to gain a foothold in the higher education system. With more, here's National Education and Parenting reporter Connor Duffy.
Growing up in poverty in Morwell in Victoria's Latrobe Valley, Jade Smith had bigger challenges at school than just making sure she did her homework.
Finances were, to put it bluntly, quite tight for most of my upbringing. You know, it was difficult to even pay for food and bills sometimes, let alone, say, school supplies.
Nevertheless, Jade Smith had big dreams, aiming to become not just the first in her family to study at university, but the first to obtain a doctorate.
The idea of university was something that was really unattainable and quite fantastical to some degree. I didn't know anyone who had been to university.
Today she's well and truly on track and has started on her master's degree. Still, it can be lonely on campus, and the government's recently announced Higher Education Accord called for more support for students from low SES, First Nations and regional backgrounds. Federal Education Minister Jason Clare will today announce $16 million in funding for 10 new study hubs to be built mostly in the bush.
You know, I want more people to get a crack at going to university, and that's what these hubs are all about. At the moment, almost half young Australians in their 20s and 30s have a uni degree, but that's not the case everywhere. It's certainly not the case in regional Australia.
Minister Clare says the new study hubs will be built in East Arnhem Land in the NT, Victor Harbour in South Australia, Warwick, Chinchilla, Innisfail and Longreach in Queensland, King Island in Tasmania, Katanning and the Pilbara in Western Australia and East Gippsland in Victoria.
These hubs are all about making it easier to get a university degree where you live without having to pick up and pack up and move to a big city or a big regional town where a university is. And the evidence is that where they work.
The new sites add to an existing network of 34 study hubs established under the coalition government. The Education Minister, Jason Clare, says the study hubs aren't just about access to computers and technology.
They'd see people there as well, people that can help you with the academic side of doing a university degree, but people that can help you with social and emotional well-being part of being alone sometimes for a long period of time. Studying a university degree, it's harder when you do it alone, when you're not with a bunch of friends in a classroom.
It comes as the minister works on the government's recently released university accord, which called for Australia to lift the numbers of university students from 860,000 today to 1.8 million in 2050 to meet the country's skills challenges.
Connor Duffy. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Nick Grimm.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Right now, thousands of people across the country are receiving unwelcome attention from the ATO as the tax office works to recover historical debts that it had previously put on hold.
Today, business reporter Nassim Kadem on why the ATO is trying to recover the funds now and why some people are comparing it to robo-debt. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.